Good to see you this morning again. I'll not repeat all the remarks I made earlier, but just to thank you again, the elders especially, for allowing me to come here again, another opportunity to see you and to speak with you concerning things that are eternal, and hopefully to have to make some type of contribution in your life as a child of God, and if you're not, to urge you to become such, that we might all be what God would have us to be and be prepared for death and for eternity. I've always enjoyed every visit here to Payton City. You've been an encouragement to me. The two times that my wife has come with me, she enjoyed you so much, and she will not ever forget you. But pleasure to enjoy your company and to see you by face. Be patient with me while I relearn all of your names and put a face with a name and vice versa. But again, if you have need of me this week, if Brother Hafley and I could do any visit in behalf of souls or to talk with anyone, I'd be just happy to do that. Whatever contribution I could make, I would be grateful to do it. I want to continue with you, Psalms 127. We were talking about this psalm. It's one of those didactic psalms, an instructional song. It's called the Song of Degrees because these Song of Degrees were not necessarily sung in worship in the tabernacle in David's time and in the temple later in Solomon's time, but just simply sung by the people generally, just common hymns or psalms that people would generally sing. A didactic psalm generally had one lesson to it. There, let me mention the didactic psalms, or Psalm 120 through 134, 15 of them. But they had some point to make about things that were common to people. Solomon wrote three psalms, 72, 127, and 132. And in this psalm, 127, he's talking about the building of a family. And although he made a complete wreck of his family life, nevertheless, he knew what was right. And so that way with many of us, we make a complete a miserable failure in our family life, and yet we know in our better self and in our soul just what God's will is and what we should desire by way of this most valuable of human relations. But except the Lord build the family, and he's talking about family life. And we pointed out that you have to start right. And young people, those of you who are not married, have not reached that point in your life yet, start out right. Begin it rightly. Take your time. Be mature. Grow up mentally, emotionally, educationally. Be willing and be able to take your place in family life. Be able to take your place in society and to make a contribution for good. Be ready to marry. Be a person who does not marry too soon. Your chances are greatly improved the older you are when you get married in the kind of society in which we live. I know that used to many of us married young and we went right straight to work, or we were in college or school and studied and we worked. We didn't depend upon our parents to support us. We didn't go live with our parents. If you got married then, you just went to work and you were with your husband or with your wife and you took care of yourself. But nowadays, that's so radically changed. If you're not able to support a wife, if you're not able to do your duty to husband and wife, well, then don't get married yet. My papa used to say, don't marry until you're able to support a wife. And words of wisdom, and that's still the way it ought to be. So give yourself plenty of time, because if you make the fundamental mistake of marrying someone that you'll never be compatible with, someone who will not share your faith in Christ and in the truth, and your desire, hopefully, to go to heaven, then you are going to be misfits in your marriages all the while. So be careful who you marry. And we were looking at the phrase, except the Lord keep the city, the watchman waketh but in vain. If you do not allow God to build your family life, it'll be in vain. And except a nation and a city and a village acknowledges God, it will be in vain. The watchman cannot protect the city. He may sound a warning, but he cannot protect the city. The people of this country cannot protect our heritage, nor our society, nor civilization, nor our political system, except the Lord keep it. It has to be because God rules in the nations of men. People are his, the world is his, and he rules in the affairs, and when we do not acknowledge him, then it will go for naught. And we were talking about this crime bill that was introduced and passed in our Congress some 3 or 4 years ago, and so much publicity and great things they said. Going to pass an omnibus crime bill. Have 100,000 new policemen. Been about now about 13,000, 14,000, 15,000 new ones, but they can't pay for it. And everybody knew that they couldn't pay for it when they passed it, but you know, that's just a lot of politics, a lot of yelping up in Washington, but, and they'll never pay for it. They can't pay for what to do. All the bureaucrats we have, you can't begin to pay. But anyway, it would make no difference if there were 200,000 new policemen in the country, or 300,000, or a half million, or a million. You could put a policeman on every street corner in Wheeling, West Virginia, or down at Parkersburg, or down in Nashville, Tennessee, or Chicago, or New York City, or Atlanta, or Miami, or Los Angeles. You could put a policeman on every street corner and put some more in patrol cars patrolling the area, and you could do that, and you still wouldn't keep down crime. The only thing that's going to keep people from being criminals and be filled with mischief and with meanness is to have a conscience against evil. And the very thing that causes people to have a conscience against evil, we have ruled out of our national life. We have ruled God out of our national life, out of our society. We have ruled and legislated God out of our school system. God is legislated out of our political system. And now we're beginning to, having sown the whirlwind, we're reaping the fruit of what we have sown. And it's just beginning. It's going to get worse. It's not going to get better. Because no longer do we as a nation of people acknowledge God Almighty. No longer do we honor Him in our public institutions and in our social compacts. And the result is, therefore, that there is no teaching of God's will except in private situations, hopefully in your home and mine, hopefully in congregations. But we as a people have little by little allowed the liberals and the atheists and the skeptics and the immoralists and all of them to legislate God. And we have stood by and let that happen to us as a nation of people. And so we are always, therefore, having these great social problems and difficulties of every kind, and it will continue. Except the Lord keep the city, unless people know about God, know His will, have a conscience as regarding evil and wrongdoing and doing what is right, you'll never keep down crime. And all the policemen in the world cannot keep it from happening. Why is it you don't go out here and rob somebody? Why is it you don't kill somebody? Why is it that you're not immoral? I can tell you why. It's because you believe in God, you believe in His will, and you have cultivated a consciousness against those things. And you're not going to do it because God teaches us not to do that. And you go about trying to live soberly, righteously, and godly because your Father in heaven teaches you to live that way. That's why it is. And good behavior always is undergirded by what God says and not for what people in the world say. And therefore, we're destroying and have destroyed and rapidly deteriorating the foundations of our society and, of course, everything that is good as regarding that matter. But except the Lord keep the city, the watchman waketh but in vain. In Psalms 121, the psalmist talked about God keeping His people. He said, I will lift up mine eyes unto the hills from whence cometh my help. My help cometh from Jehovah, who made heaven and earth. He will not suffer thy foot to be moved. He that keepeth thee will not slumber. Behold, he that keepeth Israel now shall neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord is thy keeper. The Lord is thy shade upon thy right hand. The sun shall not smite thee by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord shall preserve thee from all evil. He shall preserve thy soul. The Lord shall preserve thy going out and thy coming in from this time forth and even forevermore. Who is it that preserves the people? In sleep and in awakening, in day and night. It is God who preserves people. It is God who protects people. It is God who protects nations of people. And when we refuse God and we set Him aside and think we have no need of Him and do not even acknowledge that He exists, you may be sure that we're going to pay the terrible penalties that we're paying, and even worse. It is vain, the psalmist said, Solomon speaking, for you to rise up early, to sit up late, to eat the bread of sorrows, for so He giveth His beloved sleep. The proverb said, chapter 3, verse 24, when thou liest down, thou shalt not be afraid. Yea, thou shalt lie down, and thy sleep shall be sweet. You enjoy a night of sweet sleep and sweet slumber and sweet rest, and arise with the morning waking hours to be refreshed in body and mind. That's what the psalmist said that God can do for you. But he said He giveth His beloved sleep. He gives you rest, and He gives you peace. Jesus came to bring peace. You know, in the book of Genesis, when Jacob blessed his children, he said that the scepter would not depart from Judah until Shiloh comes. Shiloh is a beautiful word in all its derivatives. Siloam and Shiloah and Shiloh, but it means rest and peace. And so God would give people rest and peace. And he gives us rest and peace through our Savior and forgiveness. Until Shiloh come, I was born about 35 miles from Shiloh Battleground. My dad never did own an automobile. And when I was a youngster growing up, if I could catch a ride down to Shiloh, oh, I was just fascinated by that. Growing up sort of in the heart of the Confederacy down there and knowing the great battle and reading about it, you know, and all the people that died there in that 2 days battle. And I was just always, still am, I've taken my grandchildren to Shiloh. But more than that, it would impress me the name of the place, Shiloh. There was a little church building, a Methodist church house by the name of Shiloh. Shiloh Methodist Church, that's where the battleground got its name. But you know that's a beautiful word. And it means peace. And it means comfort. And it means rest. And God will give you peace. And will give you rest. And so that's what it says here. You see, giveth his beloved sleep. Only God can give you peaceable rest. Only God can give you a peaceable heart. Only God can make us peaceable people. Jesus came and preached peace to those that are far off, the Gentiles and those who were nigh, the Jews. He's the Prince of Peace. He came that we might have peace in our hearts. Therefore, being justified by faith, we have peace with God, Romans chapter 5 and verse 1. Paul said, Romans chapter 12, that we are to live as much as life in you, live peaceably with all men. God's people are a peaceable people. We're not a compromising people, but we're not a Banny Rooster people either. We're not always out looking for a scrap and a fight. We're not always antagonistic. We're not trying to stir up something and to cause friction between people. Not that at all. We are, as much as life in us, we're to live peaceably with all men. As regarding our brethren, in Romans chapter 14, the apostle said, do those things which make for peace and things wherewith you may edify one another. We are to edify each other. We're to help each other go to heaven. We're a family of God's children dwelling together with the intent of going to heaven when after a while. And I'm to help you to do that and to think in those terms. You're to help me to do that. And so we're to do those things which make for peace and things wherewith we edify one another. But God gives us peace and rest. But look at the first part of that verse. It is vain for you to rise up early, to set up late, to eat the bread of sorrow. For so he giveth his beloved sleep. Somebody said it's vain to close the gate when the cow's already out. And you know that's so. After the time has gone by and we've missed our chance and our opportunity, it doesn't come again. And in building our family, and that's what Solomon's talking about, in building our family, we don't get a second chance. We don't go back and rectify and undo all the mistakes that we make. We don't go back and make up for lost time because time lost is lost. And never do you make it up. It is not possible for us to relive things. It is not possible for us to undo matters and to do them over again. And acting upon knowledge and age and experience to do it better the next time. We don't get that second chance. And so here we are as we build our family. As we enter into our marriage, there has to be proper standards of conduct from the very courtship and then on into marriage and then the building of our family with our children. There has to be day by day. You know, no perfect parents, no perfect husband, no perfect wife, no perfect children. A family is a group of imperfect people living together, learning how to do their duty to God and to each other. Hopefully, we're learning that. And so family life is every day a learning experience. And as we grow older, it still is. Even when our children are gone from us, we're learning how to be good father-in-law and mother-in-law. We're learning how to be good grandparents and to influence our family for good. All of life is always a learning experience. You never cease to learn. None of us ever know it all. In any activity, in any sphere of our life, we're always a learning, practicing people, trying to do better, trying to improve. And it is vain for you to rise up early and to wring your hands and to shed the tears of a broken heart and eat the bread of sorrows and bemoan the fact of all of the mistakes that we make. Dear ones, we make them for sure. Even with the best intentions, we shall make them. But let me tell you something. If you are a conscientious father or mother, husband or wife, parent, grandparent, grandfather, grandmother, any one of us, day by day, we are to be very, very alert and very, very conscious of the fact of our duties of serving God and of helping our family and helping our brothers and sisters and helping our fellow man. You see, it doesn't do any good to lose sleep. And yet this is what happens. We rise up early because we can't sleep. We set up late because we can't sleep. We pop the pills to give us comfort, to give us ease, to get us high so we can stay awake maybe, or to cause us to go to sleep. We're the pill-poppingest people that ever existed on the face of this earth. And did you know that? And we have more, with all of our material prosperity, we have more problems, more difficulties, take more pills than any people on the face of the earth. And it shows, therefore, there's something wrong with us, basically. And the wrong is that we do not take advantages of our opportunities and use our time wisely for good. And while we have the chance to do well in our lives as Christians, but especially here Solomon is talking about in our family life, after our marriages are destroyed, after love has gone out the window and distrust and discord and hate maybe has taken its place, and after we have failed with our children, not having taught them, not having prayed with them, not having guided them, and they are away from us and lost in sin and out in the world, what good is it going to be for us to wring our hands and to cry bushels of, or tubs of tears, I should say, bushel won't hold many tears, but tubs of tears and just cry rivers of tears and wring our hands and take the pills and worry to death about our children when all of it will be in vain? It will not accomplish anything. And therefore, you have Solomon saying this. He's saying, in other words, in building your family, use your time and use your opportunity while you have it. While you have your little ones with you, while you have your husband with you, while you have your wife with you, do your best. Do our duty. Be what the kind of person we ought to be in dealing with those who love us the most and whom we love the most. This is what Solomon is saying. But he comes to another facet of this family life. And that's when our children enter the picture. Children ought to be honorably born. There ought not to be children born out of wedlock. Yet 33%, somebody said on the television just a day or two ago, since I've been at Elk Fork last week, I was watching this program about marriage and family life. 32%, they said, I read just a few months back, 33%, one out of every three children born into this country nowadays, in this country, illegitimate children, born without legal fathers, children born whose fathers will not accept responsibility for them, a degree of illegitimacy like that. And what this does, of course, it's so destructive, but particularly, as Solomon is talking about right in this section, it's so destructive to a child. How does a child explain when they become aware of it, old enough to be aware of it, that he or she is an illegitimate child, born out of wedlock, born out of a legal arrangement in marriage, born to a mother, maybe who was immoral, and born to a daddy who would not accept responsibility and who would not own up to being the daddy of that child? What does a child think? What kind of a burden does that put on a youngster all of their days, as long as they live? How sad it is that people will do that to their unborn. Of course, we talk about nowadays killing their unborn. 1.5 million and probably 2 million children in our country murdered before ever they are allowed to live in this world. Killed before they are born. But they're still children. And they still are, by God, they're still His creation. And it's still murder to kill children. But anyway, what about the children here who, after they are born, and they have this burden to bear, this cross, all of their days because of the foolishness and the immorality and the lack of maturity on the part of people who conceived them and brought them into this world? Don't do that to a child. Children ought to be legitimately, rightly born. And so the psalmist says here, in dealing with building the family, he said, "Lo, children are a heritage of the Lord." The word heritage means a family of heirs. They belong to God. They're not our children. Our four sons, Mary Neal and I, had these four sons. Now they're long since grown. Gone from us. Youngest 36, the oldest 45. 7 grandchildren. We don't have our boys with us anymore. They're making their way in the world. They're doing their thing. They think their thoughts. They have their families, except one who's not married. And so here they are out in the world. And our influence over them, particularly as in their early days, is not there. But they still, of course, live and breathe and understand the kind of family life they had. And they still see their father and mother as the kind of people we were and are in our family relationship. And they'll see that as long as they live. But all the while, they know, and my wife and I knew when our little boys were born, that they were not really our children. No, the psalmist says they are the heritage of the Lord. Sometimes we don't stop to think about that. We, you know, have these precious little bundles of joy born into the world, and we hold them in our arms, and we cuddle them, and they just are such a blessing to us. And after a while, if we're not careful, they'll be a curse to us. And they break our hearts. They step upon our feet when they're little, and they step upon our hearts and break them when they're older, and seem without concern regarding their parents. But they belong to the Lord. The ancients understood that, I think, better than we do. You have examples of this in the Bible. You know, Jacob left home at age 77. He was 77 years old when he left home. And I know that was so because he was 91 when Joseph was born, and Joseph was born in the 14th year of his marriage, of his working. He worked 7 years and got Leah, you know, on the wedding night. A week later, he got Rachel, the one whom he chose. God chose Leah for him, and he chose Rachel for himself, so he wound up with two wives. But it was Leah's child who was Judah, who had the seed promise, and it was Leah who was blessed, and it was Leah who was buried, that Jacob was buried by, not Rachel. God chose Leah for him, and he chose Rachel. He made the wrong choice. He looked on the outward appearance, not on the heart. But to go into all that. But Jacob was 77 years old when he got married, when he left home. And he fell immediately for Rachel when he saw her, worked 7 years for her, and he was 84 years old. And that wedding night, he got the wrong woman. And his dad-in-law explained to him the next morning that it's not our custom that the younger should have a husband before the elder. And so, Jacob, that's why I gave you Leah, and I pulled this little fast one on you. But anyway, now you work for me another 7 years, and I'll let you have Rachel after another week. So here, within a week's time, you wind up with two women. And then he got two more in the process, two concubines, Bilhah and Zilpah, and so had two sons each by them. But here he is, and he's 91 years old when Joseph is born. The reason I know that is that Joseph was 39 when his father came down to Egypt, and Jacob was 130. And so you take 39 from 130, that leaves 91, and that's how old Jacob was when Joseph was born. So that's interesting. And then Benjamin would be born a bit later. But it's an interesting thing here that in these years, the 7 years, Leah had four sons, and Rachel didn't have any children. And she watched her sister begin to have these children, four sons. And she began to cry out to her husband. And Genesis chapter 30 records that. She said to her husband, Jacob, she said, you give me children or else I die. I'd rather be dead, Jacob, than not have any children. You give me children. And Jacob was incensed at her. He was perturbed at her for speaking to him that way. And he said, am I God? It is God who has shut your womb. It is God who withholds children from you, woman. It is God who gives us children. And that was obvious because he had four sons already by Leah. He had sons by Bilhah, would later, and by Zilpah, and then later on two more sons by Leah and Dinah. She had seven children in all, six sons and one daughter. Leah did. And so here he said, it is God who's withhold children from you. And so it's that time that she took her concubine, Bilhah, and gave her to Jacob to have children by, but that didn't work. And so finally, in the 14th year, when Jacob was 91, Joseph was born to Rachel. And then some bit later, Benjamin was born to her as they came back into the land of Canaan and down near Bethlehem, and she died and is buried there. But I'm just saying to you, Jacob knew. So here he is, he's got at the end of his coming back as he comes back and after the death of his wife, before her death really, when she's expecting Benjamin, Esau comes out to meet him, Genesis 33. His brother, whom he hadn't seen now in 21 years. And so Esau comes out with 400 men. And Jacob is afraid, and so he gets the women and their children, the concubines and their children, and he sends them all up here, and he sends gifts ahead to Esau. Esau's coming with 400 men, and you know, 21 years before, Esau said, Jacob, I'll kill you. Once our father's dead, I'll kill you. And the father was still living. The mother died. Jacob never saw Rebekah, his mother, anymore once she sent him away. And that's sad because she doted on that boy, and he doted on her, and he was her favorite, and she loved him better than she did Esau, and yet she's the one that finagled all this thing to get her son to get the blessing. And then she has to send him away to get him away from the wrath of his brother. And Esau said, I'll kill you, Jacob. When our father's dead, I'll kill you. But you know, 21 years now, 20 and a half really had gone by, and that had sort of pacified, you know, and Esau had forgotten that. And he comes into view with these 400 men, and instead of doing his brother harm, he comes, he runs to Jacob, the Bible says, Genesis 33, and he hugs Jacob, and they kiss one another, and they weep together. And so here they're reconciled after all these many years. And the scripture says that Esau lifted up his eyes, and he saw these four women, and he saw these dozen children, and he said, Jacob, who are those with thee? Where on earth did you get all these? And Jacob replied, these are the children which God hath graciously given thy servant. God gave them me. God hath graciously given them to me. You ask, where did I get these, Esau? I tell you that God gave them to me. Jacob understood that. I want to ask you a question. How many of you parents and grandparents, but parents, when your children are small and little, how many of you have stood by the side of the little bed or the little crib of your beloved little child or children, and you have stood there and held your wife's hand and thanked God in prayer for that child or those children? And how many of you have ever said, Lord, I thank thee for this child or for these children which thou hast given us? You ever do that? You don't do that, you don't know where your children came from. You think they're yours, don't you? Oh, no, they're not yours. You'll only have them just for a little while. God entrusts them to you and to me to teach them and to train them about God, their real father. Bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. And pretty soon, just after a few years, they're listening to other people. They're paying no attention to your parents. Not really. They're listening to their little friends and their peers. They're listening to the television. They're listening to their teachers. They're listening to others who are becoming to have more influence in their lives than the parents. You don't have your children but just a little while. And yet these are the children which God hath graciously given thy servant. Joseph was about 7 years old that day when he saw Uncle Esau for the first time. And he heard his father make that statement, these are the children which God hath graciously given thy servant. And the years pass by, and Joseph is now 56 years old, and he's the prime minister of the land of Egypt, next to Pharaoh himself. You know the circumstances of Joseph. Slavery, Potiphar's house, prison, then by interpretation of dream, elevated to the prime ministership of the land of Egypt. And so here he is, and he's 56 years old. He's been prime minister in Egypt for 26 years. And his father has come down and has been there 17 years. And his dad is 147 years old and he's on his deathbed. And his father is blind like his father Isaac had been. And so Jacob calls his son Joseph to come to him and to bring his son. He said, I will bless them. Joseph, bring your son. I will bless them before I die. And so Joseph, obedient son that he was, prime minister of the land, great man in the kingdom, next to Pharaoh. And here's his old, wore-out, aged father, blind, lying on his deathbed. And that Joseph gets his boys and obeys his dad just like he was a little boy himself. Comes into the presence of the patriarch. And Joseph arises, the Bible says, upon his bed, or Jacob. And he said, Joseph, who are those with thee? Whom have you brought to me? You see, years before, he never forgot it. He deceived his daddy. He deceived his daddy and made his brother to bear the brunt of his misdeeds. And Jacob never could have forgotten that, and he's not going to let that happen to him. Whom have you brought to me, Joseph? And Joseph said, these are my sons. Genesis 48, verses 8 and 9. These are my sons, whom God hath given me in this place. Here in the land of Egypt, Father, God hath given me these two sons. Joseph knew where his boys came from. He knew they were not his sons. No, God gave them to me. Jacob said, God gave me these children. That's what this passage says. Children are heritage of the Lord. They're not our children. He lets a man and woman procreate a human body after their kind. But it is God who creates the spirit. You don't have power to create a spirit. Spirits are created by God. We have the fathers of our flesh, Paul said, and we have the father of our spirit, Hebrews 12, verse 9. It is God who formeth the spirit of man within him, Zechariah 12 and 1. It is God who puts the spirit in the midst of the body, Daniel 7, 15, and in 2 Corinthians 5, verse 1. And this body becomes the tabernacle, a dwelling place for a spirit that God creates. And then when death comes, when that body and spirit separate, at whatever age and time, the spirit returneth unto God who gave it. God gave the spirit. He created the spirit. He's the father of spirits. You don't create spirits. Man and a woman can procreate a body, a human body after their kind. God allows us to do that. But we don't procreate spirits. It is God who creates the spirit and infuses it into that body. It is God who can only create a spirit, just as he creates the angels who are spirits. But he creates these human spirits, called human, and they dwell in that body, and death then separates the body and spirit. The spirit goes to God who gave it, and the body returns to the dust from which it came. God is the father of spirits, and Jacob knew that, and Joseph knew that. And there's an interesting sidelight to that, because Joseph's two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. Manasseh the older, Ephraim the younger. Two sons Joseph had. Manasseh means forgetfulness. For God hath enabled me to forget my father's house, said Joseph. He did not see any of his family for 22 years. He was sold into slavery at age 17, and he did not see any of them again until he was 39 years old. 22 years, he never heard from his daddy, and he never heard from his brothers, and they didn't know what had happened to him, and even after he was prime minister of Egypt, he didn't care to go back over there and see about them. He could have, but he didn't. And he had these boys, and he said, Manasseh means forgetfulness. God hath enabled me to forget my sorrows in the land of my affliction. God has allowed me to forget it. Forget all those people back over yonder. And then his second son was born by the name, and he called him Ephraim, because he said, God hath enabled me to be fruitful in the land of my affliction. God has enabled me to forget, and God has enabled me to be fruitful. And those were his two sons. And oh, a remarkable event happened that day he brought him to his father. Because old aged Jacob, the great patriarch, blind and wore out and feeble, but still had his mental faculty. And Jacob said, Joseph, today, as of today, your sons will be my sons. They will be called the sons of Jacob, no longer the sons of Joseph. They will be my sons, and I will number them among my sons, and they shall inherit in the land of Canaan. Any children you have after this, Joseph, will be your sons. But as of today, your two sons are my sons. Remarkable, the power of a patriarch, wasn't it? That a granddaddy could say regarding his grandsons, I'll take these sons today. No longer, Father, will you have custody of them. My son. And you know what he did? He gave Manasseh the right of the firstborn in the land of Canaan. He gave Manasseh the right of the firstborn, a double portion of all the inheritance in the land of Canaan. He gave Manasseh great territory over to the east of the Jordan, to the east of the Sea of Galilee, called the Golan. Now, the Golan Heights, all of that area, the old ancient land of Bashan. And he gave Manasseh one of the choice parts to the southwest of the Sea of Galilee in the land of Canaan proper. Manasseh received twice the territory that any of the other children received. Jacob gave him the right of the firstborn. Amazing, isn't it? And he gave Ephraim in the northern part of the land of Canaan the choice part. And Ephraim became the outstanding tribe, the outstanding people among the 10 tribes when the kingdom separated. Jacob blessed those boys, and they were called his sons from that day on. Amazing story. But my point is here that what the psalmist Solomon said is so. Children are a heritage of the Lord. They're his children. And the fruit of the womb is his reward. As arrows are in the hand of a mighty man, so are the children of his youth. I thank God that God lets us have our children when we are young. And to have children is one of the greatest of blessings. As I mentioned, Genesis 30, Rachel cried out to her husband because she was barren and she had no child. God maketh the barren woman to keep house and to be the joyful mother of children. Praise ye the Lord, Psalms 113, verse 9. God lets the barren woman to be the mother of children. And so Hannah, you remember the story of that great lady. Hannah had a husband by the name of Elkanah. But in those days, polygamy was practiced, and Elkanah had another wife by the name of Peninnah. And Elkanah had children by Peninnah, but he had no children by Hannah. Hannah was barren, and she had no child. And year by year, she went with her husband who loved her, went to the tabernacle at Shiloh and offered sacrifice. And she took all of the taunts of her rival, of Peninnah, and saw Peninnah's children growing up here. And yet all the while, Elkanah was saying to Hannah, Hannah, I love you better than 10 sons. Because you have no children doesn't mean I don't love you. God just withholds children from you. But I love you, and I'm better to you than 10 sons would be. But oh, she chafed at that. And Hannah wanted a child. And that year they went to Shiloh from Ramah, where they lived, offered the sacrifice, and as the proceedings were about over, Hannah began to pray. And her mouth uttered no words. Her lips did move, but no spoken words were heard. But from the depth of her soul, she talked to God Almighty. When you really pray, dear one, God knows your words, and you don't have to utter them. And you speak from God deep down in your soul and from your heart. And God, who knoweth our hearts and our thoughts, he understands what we're talking about when we're unable to utter those things that we'd like to say. And so she prayed. And she made a vow to God, if you will give me a man-child, I will give him to you all the days of his life. He'll be a Nazarite from birth. No razor will ever come on his head. He will never cut his hair. He will never touch a dead body. He'll never drink strong drink. That was the vow of the Nazarite. And the mother would put it on that child from birth. And old Eli the priest, he sat over the post over by the door of the tabernacle. And he saw this woman. And he saw her mouth moving, but nothing was said. And she's a drunken woman. And he upbraided her. Why do you come to the tabernacle drunken? Why don't you quit your drinking? Oh, nay, my Lord. Out of the sorrow of my heart have I cried out to God. I've made a vow to God. I've asked God. You don't understand, but God knows. And Eli changed his tune real quickly. He prayed that God would grant her whatever it was and would bless her. And she went her way and went back to Ramah with her husband. And in the course of time, she was with child. And she gave birth to one of the greatest men that ever lived on the face of God's good earth. And one of the greatest men of the Bible. A man almost without any blemish whatever. Samuel. Lent from God. Helped by God. And so God is my helper. And God gave me this child, she said. Named him Samuel. But then when she took him at age 3 to the tabernacle to leave him there and let him be raised by the priest and by the women who waited there, lent from God. I lend this child to God all the days of his life. Lent to God. And you know, she weaned that child at the age of 3 years. She nursed him till he was 3 years old. And she, at the end of 3 years, went back to the tabernacle and took 3 bullocks. One for each year. That's how you know how old Samuel was. 3 years old. When he was taken to the tabernacle, and those bullocks were offered by his mother, and she completed her vow. And Samuel, her son, lent to God, became one of the greatest men that ever lived. Oh, with a mother like that, how could he be otherwise? With a father and a mother who are godly people, how could children be otherwise? And sometimes it seems that they are. But this is what God intends. God intends that we understand that our children are given us by Him, that they belong to Him, that He lends us those children for a little while. They're made in His image, and we're to bring them up by His will, and we're to teach them of the Heavenly Father. People get interested in their lineage. I've been somewhat interested in my father's side of the family. I haven't done any much work on my mother's side. Don't think that I will. But anyway, and not a whole lot on my dad. But you know, I always remind myself, Bill, what value is this? It makes no difference about all those people you never met, never knew. Afraid to get a little bit too much involved in it. Might find some bootleggers, some horse thieves. Who knows? People spend time in the pen for bootlegging, you know, and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, what difference does that make? Our lineage and our heritage is from God. It is God who created us, our Father in heaven. And He's the one that we need to know of. And as arrows are in the hand of a mighty man, a warrior, so are the children of his youth. The warrior, he has his quiver full of arrows. And he goes out to do battle with his bow and his arrow, and he goes out to be victorious, and the children of a man and a woman compared to the arrows of a mighty man. And then this last verse here is so interesting. Happy or blessed is the man that hath his quiver full of them. As the man who has his quiver full of arrows, so is the man that hath, as it were, his house filled with children. In Psalms, the next Psalm, 128 and verse 3, thy wife shall be as a fruitful vine by the sides of thine house, thy children as olive plants round about thy table. Thy wife a fruitful vine, and thy children as olive plants round about your house and around your table. They shall not be ashamed, but they shall speak with the enemies in the gates. Let me close the lesson by saying this. What that says is that our children that God gives us will grow up, and they'll take care of us if we live to be old people. When we get to the point in our lives where we cannot care for ourselves, and when we have to have help, it'll be our children who will be our best helpers, if we have brought them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. You have known, and I know, children who could care very little and who would not give the snap of their fingers for their parents. They're unappreciative. They're unthankful. They're without understanding. They do not know nor realize any sacrifice their parents ever made. Never stop to think about it. Some children are just completely reprobate as regarding their parents. Without natural affection, turn away from their parents. I buried a woman not long ago. I say I buried her, conducted a service. Undertaker buried her. Son and a daughter. Son wouldn't even come to her funeral. Angry with his mother. Daughter reluctantly came to the funeral and made the decisions as regarding the burial of her mother. Wanted nothing to do with her mother. And her mother, in my judgment, and other people that knew her longer than I, said she wasn't that terrible of a woman. Had a lot of sorrows in life, a lot of difficulties. Had a hard way to go in raising two children by herself. Husband left her very early in life with two children. And she did her best. She didn't do her best probably at worship and service and bringing those children to services and teaching them. But she had a hard road to hoe in life. But those children cared nothing for her. And you know, one of the interesting sidelights was that this girl has a little girl, and she wouldn't even let the little granddaughter come and see the corpse of her mother. Wouldn't even let her little child attend the funeral of the grandmother. And another interesting sidelight was that this daughter did not want the diamond rings that her mother had. She had on her wedding rings, and we buried that mother with those wedding rings on. First time in my life and only time that I've ever done that. And I tried my best to get that girl to take those rings off the corpse of her mother and save them for that child. I want nothing to do with it, she said. Isn't that amazing? All kinds of people in this old world. But they shall not be ashamed, but they shall speak with the enemies in the gate. Best life insurance you can have is to rear good children. Best life insurance you can have is to have children who love you and love the Lord and will stand by you just as you stood by them. You do your duty. You cast your bread upon the waters. And Ecclesiastes chapter 11 says, after many days it will return. You bestow your gifts upon your children. I'm not talking about material gifts. But you bestow the gifts of love and teaching and concern and discipline and instruction and affection. And after many days, you will reap what you have sown. Children will rise up and take care of their parents. Let me give you a story, a true story as a close. Years ago, in the years that I lived in Port Arthur, Texas, we wrote a bulletin down there, sent it out, a monthly bulletin, for 17 years. And in that bulletin, that paper, 8-page monthly paper, I had a question and answer page every month. So I answered as best as could. I said, I don't know any way that Churches of Christ could set up pension plans for old preachers, because there's not any kind of centralized authority to do such. Every congregation is independent. I know that there are congregations that help older preachers, and especially preachers who have worked with them in their old age. I've known of congregations that gave a preacher a house to live in. I've known of congregations that supported an older preacher and his wife as long as they lived, because they appreciated the work that they did and who they were and what they stood for. I've known of congregations, that's unusual, but there are a number that have done it and still do it. But I do not know of any way you could set up some kind of a centralized pension plan for preachers or anybody else. I mentioned that. I said the next thing is that preachers need to try to be frugal, not stingy now and selfish, but try to be frugal and try to save some along. And to make some kind of investment, more than just Social Security, for their old age. Realizing that they're going to get old. Don't spend everything you make. Live carefully. Live frugally, and save something for a rainy day. Preachers themselves ought to do that, just like everybody ought to do that. But I said the third thing is, they ought to raise good children. I thought she needed to know that. I said the best children, the best life insurance that a preacher can have is good children. And I said, generally, if a man is a good man and a good preacher, he's raised good children. And those children will reciprocate, and they'll take care of their mother and daddy when they're old. I said, that's the best life insurance policy you can have. Good children. So I just left it that. And I've often wondered if that woman got the phone. Write me and ask me, why don't the brethren take care of the preacher? When here is a preacher with several children, and it never maybe occurred to that one at least, that she might have an obligation and responsibility to help take care of a mom and dad if they needed it. Amazing thing about us, isn't it? We'd like to shift it off to the government. We'd like to shift it off to the brethren. And we'd like to shift it off to somebody else while we go scot-free. And that's not right. But thank you for listening. Except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. Except the Lord keep the city, the watchman waketh but in vain. It is vain for you to rise up early and to sit up late and eat the bread of sorrow. For so he giveth his beloved sleep. Lo, children are a heritage of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is his reward. As arrows are in the hand of a mighty man, so are the children of his youth. Happy is the man that hath his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed. They shall speak with the envious in the gate. They'll take care of them. They'll rise up. They'll plead your cause. They'll stand by your side. They'll defend you. They'll help you. And then they'll shed a tear when they bury your body in the grave. And they'll have sweet memories of a godly father and a godly mother who loved the Lord and who tried to teach them the right ways of the Lord. And what greater blessing could you have than godly parents resulting in godly children? Let's give it a try, dear one. Be conscious of it every day. Greatest degree of happiness you'll ever experience in this life will be to see your children grow up before you as godly and good men and women to serve the Lord and to do His will in preparation for heaven. You'd be subject to invitation today to come and be baptized for remission of sin Jesus said, he that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. If that be your need, you ought to come and not delay any longer. If you need to confess wrongs and mistakes and sins in your life, you ought to come and do that. And be right with God and be the kind of believer that God would approve of. We'd invite you. We wish you'd come. We'd love to help you. And would you do that while we stand and sing if that be your need?